The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finn, and we've got a great show for you today. In this half hour of the show, we're going to be rebroadcasting an interview we had with Rabbi Joseph Telushkin and his biography of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. This week is the portion of Balak, can be found in chapter 20 and following in the book of Numbers, great Bible story stuff. We're going to be talking about some of that today also. We have a wonderful assortment of music, a great Hasidic story at the end. You stay all the way through till 12 o'clock. And before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Israel police arrested 9 Israeli Druze when a mob dragged 2 wounded Syrian fighters from an ambulance, beating one to death and seriously injuring the second. This is the Golan. The Druze believe the Syrian ISIS is killing Syrian Druze. One rocket was launched from the Rafah area. IAF planes blew up the launcher and canceled permits for Gaza to visit the Temple Mount during the month of Ramadan. Indian intelligence agencies warn police to be on the alert for terrorist attacks against Israeli tourists in India, common destination for young Israelis after their IDF service. Border policeman is in serious condition after being stabbed by an Arab terrorist in Jerusalem. The victim is in critical condition with a stab wound to his neck. The terrorist was taken to Hadassah Hospital. It's interesting they didn't take him to the same hospital, but the terrorist was taken to Hadassah Hospital and died of his wounds shortly thereafter. Hamas in Gaza claims that Golani Brigade Sergeant Aron Shaul is alive, even though the IDF officially declared him dead last August. Givati Brigadier Officer First Lieutenant Hadar Goldin was killed and his body captured in Gaza. Hamas terrorists in Gaza still have Shaul's and Golden's bodies and refuse to return them. In some polling news, I very rarely report polling news, but this is what I thought was interesting. 51% of Israelis support the two-state solution of making Judea and Samaria a Palestinian state, down from 61% last year. The poll was conducted by the Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace at Hebrew University in Jerusalem and the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research in Ramallah. New York City's 2016 budget includes $1.5 million to assist Holocaust survivors living in poverty. Currently, nearly 85% of those people who identify themselves as Holocaust survivors in New York City live on a budget of less than $18,000 per year. And that's barely enough to pay rent in New York City. And finally, listen to this one, folks. Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv added a new method of bomb detection, mice. That's right. The mice have been trained to sniff explosives, and they get all excited when they smell explosives. Oh, we smell a bomb. We smell a bomb. We smell a bomb. Anyway, the mice can even detect if someone swallowed explosive material. And I can imagine them saying, that guy was so stupid, he swallowed explosive material. Anyway, and that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Shel Fenneman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have, as promised, Rabbi Joseph Tolushin, author of Rebbe, The Life and Teachings of Menachem M. Schneerson, the Most Influential Rabbi in Modern History. How are you today, Joe?
I'm very good, and I'm happy to be on with you.
Thank you, thank you. It is indeed our honor. The Jewish Hour has been on air for 18 years, and we've been looking to get Rabbi Joseph Tolushkin on, so we're so happy that you're able to come on. I want to talk really some technical stuff about this book, Rebbe. It's been all over the internet. It's on radio shows already. You've been interviewed all over the place, and people are familiar with already a lot of the text. I want to go into first before into some technical stuff. You're right. It took you about 5 years to write the book Rebbe. So I'm thinking, did you start out saying, I'm going to write a book that's going to take me 5 years to write?
No. I hoped this book was going to take 2 years to write. And while books often do take longer than one originally thinks, I've never had such a discrepancy between my expectation and the reality. But there was so much material out there about the Rebbe, but ironically, for purposes of a biographer, very little material coming from the Rebbe. So it was hard to write a classic biography of the Rebbe. It's not like there were a lot of journals to consult. The Rebbe had hundreds of volumes of his speeches and other things recorded, but he rarely spoke about himself. He was not the sort of person who, you know, liked to throw in anecdotes from his own life. He did it occasionally, but really quite infrequently. So the book had to really involve me in interviewing so many people and going through so many interviews of others that others had done with him. And it therefore took me a while to find my writer's voice. What I really wanted to say, because you don't want the book to come out chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
So you were throwing in all the facts.
You weren't planning on having the book come out a month before the Rebbe's 20th anniversary of his passing. It's just
when I initially started on the project, no, because as I said, I started 5 years ago. I thought it would be a 2-year project, and so I thought it would come out perhaps maybe it would come out around 18 years. Then once I realized that it was going to be relatively close to this 20th year, so I knew then that there would be a revival of interest around that time. Mm-hmm. It's not totally coincidental. By the end, I knew that. It did cause me, HarperCollins, my publisher, the publisher of Rebbe, had scheduled a deadline. I don't use the word deadline anymore because the Rebbe thought that the word had a very negative connotation. It's an example where writing about the Rebbe caused me to make a change in my own life. So now instead of deadline, I say due date. And the difference is obviously dramatic, deadline connoting death and due date, you know, connoting life. So HarperCollins had assigned me a due date at the which would have ended up causing the book to be published in another few months during the fall. They also then became aware of the significance of this being the 20th anniversary of the Rebbe's death, and urged me to finish the book sooner, so I had a few months of working double time.
Okay, indeed. Let's go back even further than that. The impetus for writing the book, your grandfather was a Lubavitcher. He was also an author. I have at least one book, maybe two books on my shelf by Rabbi Nissen Tolushkin.
Mm-hmm.
Your father was the accountant for Corporate Lubavitch, and was besides
also
that
also the personal accountant for the Rebbe.
Personal accountant for the Rebbe. Was this the impetus for you writing the book, or was there something else?
I didn't really grow. You know, I grew up with these very close associations with Chabad, you know, very loving associations, but I wasn't really raised inside the movement. So the impetus was I started to realize increasingly the impact of the Rebbe. Now, remember, even when I started working on the book, it had been quite a number of years since the Rebbe's death. And anybody who's an observer of the Jewish scene, as certainly I am, you know, has been aware of the phenomenon of the incredible growth of Chabad. So if you assess the successive leadership by what happens to a movement after the leader's death, something very pretty unprecedented was happening. It wasn't a question of just keeping the movement at the same size. The movement has had this enormous expansion. And so increasingly I came to realize this is the sort of leader who comes across very, very infrequently. And what was the secret of his message? How is he continuing to inspire people? We're now dealing with a phenomenon that doesn't just affect one part of Jewry, but that has had a tremendous impact on all of Jewry. So the Rebbe, therefore, I suddenly realized this is an historical figure. And certainly worthy of a comprehensive biography, and worthy for me personally of spending a lot of time, because this is somebody from whom there is a lot to be learned.
Indeed, indeed. If you're just joining us, our guest today is Rabbi Joseph Telushkin, wrote a book called Rebbe, The Life and Teachings of Menachem M. Schneerson. I call him the Lubavitch Rebbe. So how does it work? I mean, there are two other biographies that came out this month. One by Dinstein, also one by Chaim Miller. And Dinstein's and Chaim Miller have their own publishing companies. Did you go to HarperCollins and say, I'd like to write a book about the Rebbe? And they said, sure, it sounds like a good idea to us.
No.
Okay, I didn't think so.
Quite as simply as that. First of all, you know, fortunately, I have been publishing books for quite a while. I believe this is my 19th book. So, and I have fortunately had the opportunity to publish with mainstream presses. Why do I say that that's an advantage? Because their books will be stocked in all sorts of bookstores. Sometimes if you publish with some of the smaller Jewish presses, your books will be carried only in Jewish bookstores. And particularly if you're writing a book that you want to reach out to people who might not be the sort of people who frequent Jewish bookstores, this is the sort of book to do. Having said that, I'm a very big fan of Jewish bookstores because I know that it's becoming increasingly difficult for them financially. So I want to support both. So that's the advantage of having a mainstream publisher. And I also knew that if I went to them at the very beginning of the process, they might not realize the significance of who the Rebbe was and would be less apt to want to buy the book. So I bided my time. I went with my agent, Richard Pine, who's a very successful and commercial agent. And he went to a number of different publishing houses. HarperCollins was not the only one that was interested. There were three houses that expressed some real interest. And I met with editors from those three. But at that point, I had already actually written a draft of quite a substantial part of the book. So they knew what they were getting. They read about it, and it occurred to them that the Rebbe was a more significant figure than perhaps they had understood. I was also blessed. My editor at HarperCollins is a woman who's not Jewish, Karen Rinaldi. But she had heard about the Rebbe over the years. She comes from Brooklyn, so she had heard about the Rebbe, had seen Lubavitcher Hasidim, but she had an associate editor named Jake Zabidi, who had grown up in Miami Beach, where his families were members of the Chabad synagogue there. And so he had a particular interest in seeing this book done, and that's part of the background about how it happened.
Mm-hmm. What kind of encouragement did you get from corporate Lubavitch itself, meaning Lubavitch headquarters in Brooklyn?
They were wonderful. They were very open. I think they were intrigued by the idea of somebody writing a book about the Rebbe who did not come directly from within Chabad, and therefore, as a result, whose other books had been read largely throughout the Jewish community. So, you know, I had written a book, Jewish Literacy, which has been widely read and used in all the different religious denominations. And I think that was intriguing to them and attractive to them because Chabad, understandably, sees the Rebbe as a person who has a message for the whole Jewish community and indeed for the whole world. And they were aware that if something is published internally within Chabad, the way the Rebbe is written about, you know, often written about within the movement, is obviously in a very reverential way that is not as apt to engross people who are not already sort of committed to the Rebbe. So So they really gave me access to anybody I wanted to interview. I was never told, you know, that I was never turned down. They gave me access to looking through a lot of the documents that exist. Chabad has, you know, tremendous comprehensive documents. And they did so with the understanding that they would have no editorial control over the book. They gave me, they understood that, you know, I wasn't going to turn the manuscript over to them for them to approve and say, no, this you can't have, because obviously, first of all, that would not be the right thing to do. It certainly wouldn't be right. I would certainly not consent. And also, it would destroy any credibility for the book. So they were willing to not have any editorial control. Now, also, given that they know my family background, you know, I think they had an innate sense of trust. They knew that I was going into this book not to write an expose, God forbid. First of all, it's not easy to write an expose about the Rebbe. I don't know what one's going to expose. That would be, God forbid, highly embarrassing or anything, because he lived a pretty pristine life. But they knew that I was going in with an affectionate attitude, which indeed I was. They knew I had areas of disagreement, which indeed I did have. But they knew that I had every intention of being fair. And again, I have an enormous admiration. As I said in the preface to my book, I said, obviously I went into this book with a high regard for the Rebbe. Why else would I want to spend 5 years of my life studying another man's life? And indeed, I learned that by studying his life, I learned lessons applicable to my own life.
Mm-hmm. Okay, again, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Rabbi Joseph Talishkin. He's written a book called Rebbe, The Life and Teachings of Menachem M. Schneerson. So you had an opinion and a feeling about Lubavitch and about the Rebbe. What changed, what was augmented because of your in delving and researching the Rebbe's life and work?
The sense of what a broad-based leader he was. There were a few things that did it. Number one, I had never really fully appreciated the depth of the Chabad outreach, even though I said I was struck by it. But as far as I can ascertain, this represented the first attempt in all of Jewish history to reach every single Jewish community, indeed every single Jew in the world.
Indeed.
Tied in with that was the understanding that the Rebbe, who thought in macro terms, he thought in terms of the large Jewish community, also always remained focused on the individual. I don't know of any other leader of a large movement or of a government who was able, even during his or her maximum years of leadership, to still always remain focused on the individual. Anybody who really wanted to see the Rebbe could eventually get to do so. It might be a brief meeting, but they would have that opportunity for that encounter. And so the Rebbe remained very focused always on individuals. That was another thing that struck me. Also, that his love was really given to the Jewish community in an unconditional manner. So that when people say, oh, you know, Chabad practices, the Rebbe practiced, love your neighbor as yourself. So some people think, okay, but that's always been essential in Judaism. Number one, it's the most famous law in the Torah, that and love the Lord your God are probably the two most famous laws in the Torah. And secondly, in early Jewish history already, or around 2,000 years ago, Hillel and Akiva, two of the most renowned rabbis of the Talmud, said this is the essential law of Judaism. But having said that, in real life, that's not what happened. In real life, the rabbi said the temple was destroyed because of causeless hatred within the Jewish community. And there have always been these fights, even the terrible fights that occurred, the animosity towards the Hasidim in their early years. So the Jewish community has always been filled with a lot of acrimony. It's embarrassing, you know, to an extent it's been embarrassing and it's caused a lot of problems. The Rebbe wanted to overcome it, and he understood intuitively it could only be overcome if love was not made conditional. So when Rabbi Israel Meir Lau, who in later years gained renown as Israel's chief rabbi, but when he met with the Rebbe as a young man, he was early in his rabbinical career, and the Rebbe asked him, what sort of work are you doing? And he said he's involved in Kiruv Rechokim, which is the Hebrew expression that literally means bringing near those who are far away, a euphemistic way of saying of getting non-observant Jews to become more religious Jews. And the Rebbe said, who are we to know who's near and who's far? They're all precious in God's eyes. So he didn't go out to other Jews with the attitude of his, we're the superior people, and we're going to find a way to make you also religious. He appreciated other Jews for who they were and for what they did. There was a group that subsequent to World War II, right after World War II, was called Bricha. It was a group of largely non-traditionally observant Jews who were involved in helping Jews escape from Eastern Europe, which had fallen under communist domination. The Rebbe's wife, known as the Rebbetzin, Chaya Mushka, the daughter of the previous Rebbe, used to refer to those people as tzaddikim without tefillin, righteous people who don't put on tefillin. Now, tzaddikim is about the highest appellation you can apply to anyone in Jewish life, and usually it's associated with a person who's classically pious. But the Rebbe understood that classical piety for them was expressed in love of neighbor in a manner that they were willing to risk their lives in others. So he was willing, and she was willing, to call them tzaddikim. Did they want to encourage them to do more in their lives Jewishly? Of course they did. But the love came first. The love was not made conditional on their making those changes. And very often love is made conditional. If you do this, oh, then you're worthy. And they were willing to give that love first. And when people feel loved, they are much more open to doing more.
Indeed, indeed. If you're if you're just joining us, our guest today is Joseph Telushkin, who's authored a, it's already a bestseller, a book called The Rebbe. It's a biography of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Your grandfather was a disciple of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Your father was an accountant for the Rebbe. So what I'm assuming that you had personal meetings with the Rebbe, and I wonder if maybe you might be able to share some of the things that the Rebbe said to you.
I only, unfortunately, only had one. And it was when I was about 19, and the meeting was with my father and grandfather. It was not a short meeting. It was actually about a 40-minute meeting. The unfortunate aspect of it was the meeting was in Yiddish, and my Yiddish is very weak. So my father was sort of whispering the translations to me. Now, obviously, you'll wonder, why was my Yiddish not good? My Hebrew was good. You know, I went to Hebrew-speaking schools, and even in the case of my grandfather, he and I always spoke to each other in Hebrew. So one's struck by the eyes of the Rebbe, but, you know, I feel almost, I sound like a broken record when I say that, because that's what struck everybody with the Rebbe. He had a way of looking at you, a profound way, and it was a meeting at that point. It was shortly after the Israeli Six-Day War, and my grandfather, Alav HaShalom, was about to make a trip to Israel. And, you know, and they were speaking about it both in religious and in political senses. And I was about to go. That was the immediate impetus. Also, my father wanted to make sure I came to the visit because I was about to go for a year to learn at a yeshiva in Israel. And I got a bracha from the Rebbe. In retrospect, do I regret that I did not spend more of my time speaking to my father and grandfather about the Rebbe and taking advantage of other opportunities to meet with the Rebbe? That feeling of regret was so prominent during the 5 years I was working on this book. My father, though, you know, was an accountant, and my father was present at the scene because he was at Chabad probably an average of one day a week for 40 years. And, you know, he worked immediately outside where the Rebbe's office was. So he really knew a great deal. And if I had asked specific questions, he would tell me. But my father, you know, was a fairly, he was a guarded person. He didn't just talk about things. So
client confidentiality.
I mean, well, that certainly was the case, yes. But I, you know, it wouldn't be that I'd start asking him about, you know, financial matters. But he was aware of all that was going on there. You know, he'd often come back. You know, in the 60s, even in the 50s. I was not so, you know, I was still pretty young because I was born in 48. But, you know, things that were amazing to me, they couldn't understand. You know, people would show up who had just gotten out of Russia and were Talmidei Chachamim, you know, real scholars of Judaism. And my father knew, like everybody knew, that all Jewish schooling had been outlawed in the Soviet Union. So just on the basis of an underground education, people came out very knowledgeable. So we were aware that remarkable things were happening there. But, oh, my regret that I didn't have the opportunity to interview. Obviously, the person you most want to interview if you're writing a biography is the subject himself, the Rebbe. But I somehow have a feeling, even if I had had the opportunity to interview the Rebbe, he's not going to be that forthcoming in discussing, you know, his own personal life. But my father and grandfather, you know, had been at the scene so much, I would have loved to speak to them about the Rebbe. The Rebbe is an exceedingly fascinating figure because he was an introverted person growing up who had to expand and change himself in order to become a leader. But once he did it with full heart. You know, anybody who would watch a videotape of a weekday Verbrengen, obviously when the public meetings were held on Shabbat, they couldn't be videoed. But anybody would watch a weekday Verbrengen and would see the Rebbe motioning quite very energetically, sometimes wildly with his arms, to increase the singing, the volume of the singing, the passion of the singing, would not imagine that this was an enormously private person whose aspirations in life had not been to be a leader, whose aspirations in life had been to be a scholar, who at a certain point of his life might well have thought that he was going to earn his living as an engineer and do incredible work in Jewish life and in Jewish writing and in Jewish scholarship during the rest of his time. But once he undertook this mission, he developed those parts of himself. One of the fascinating things, there's a chapter in the book about the Rebbe and the Rebbetzin. And the Rebbetzin was as private a person as he, but because she never assumed a leadership role, she was able to stay more private. And so less was known about her, but there too I had the opportunity to interview people who had interactions with her. And you find an extraordinary caring and concern and what I call moral imagination. She did the things. She could imagine what other people needed. And that was also very, very moving to learn about her.
You're talking about the Rebbetzin as the Rebbe's wife as a private person. My wife, with the impetus of a couple of other girls she was learning in Machon Chan at the time, wrote the Rebbetzin if they could meet her. And the Rebbetzin, surprisingly enough, said yes. And at the end of the meeting, without going into the whole detail, the Rebbetzin said goodbye to them and said, "Of course you won't tell anybody about this meeting, because otherwise she would just be inundated, and that's not what the Rebbetzin wanted. They didn't want their own private lives."
That's right, yes. And by the way, the Hasidim, as a rule, were exceedingly protective of that.
Indeed.
To the extent that...
Very respectful of that.
Yeah, to the extent that generally if somebody was with the Rebbetzin and her husband came home, people would, you know, would usually run out to give them some private time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I became religious in 1976, and the Rebbetzin passed away in 1988, and I never saw the Rebbetzin. I just never, I was never in a place where I ever said, someone said, "Oh, by the way, that's the Rebbetzin." No, I never, I don't know which, aside from the pictures that came out, I have no idea what she looked like. Because
right, and there actually are very few pictures. By the way, to the extent that a certain doctor in the neighborhood, I'm forgetting his name, that there was a certain doctor gets a call from a phone number, and he was a doctor who would occasionally make house calls, didn't normally. And the name of the patient who wanted to consult with him was Schneerson. He assumed it might be the Rebbe's house. On the other hand, you know, there are other Schneerson's cousins, you know, within the community. But he said he only knew that it was the Rebbe's house when he came there to treat her. And you know how he knew it?
Go ahead.
Because there was no picture of the Rebbe anywhere in the house. You know, he said he knew enough about Chabad to know if you walk into the house of a Chabadnik, you're going to see a picture of the Rebbe. And there was no pictures there of the Rebbe.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the we could talk about every story that you have in this book, but one of the stories which I had heard before, which showed the Rebbe's caring in individuals, was actually something that happened with your father after he had his stroke and was lying in the hospital. Could you just briefly tell over just
the remarkable incident? And probably now that I think about it, I know this played a very major role in what opened me up to writing this book. because it's one of the most precious memories I and my family, my sister, that we have. In June of 1986, I was living in Israel, and I got a phone call from my mother that my father had had a stroke, and it was clearly a fairly serious stroke. And so I flew home immediately. My father was unconscious and spent, you know, all the time with him. And every day we were getting two phone calls from the Chabad headquarters that the Rebbe wants to know how your father is. And finally, after a few days after I came home, my father did come out of the his state of his coma. And he was a bit disoriented. Sometimes he could be clear, sometimes he could be confused, and the calls continued to come. And then one day I got a call from Rabbi Krinsky, the Rebbe's very close aide, secretary, and he said, the Rebbe, we were having a meeting of the VOD, we were having a meeting of the leadership, and an accounting, a financial matter came up, and the Rebbe said, ask Shlomo, which is my father. And so he says, I have a question for you. So I said, Rabbi Krinsky, you know how sick my father is. He's in ICU. He's in intensive care. He said, of course. He said, we know that. And the Rebbe remembered, but nonetheless, he did have this question. So at that point, I thought, okay, I'll go ask the question. I asked the question. My father looks at me, sort of shrugs a little, if I recall correctly, and says that the answer is obvious, and then he gives the answer. At that moment, I was profoundly, profoundly moved because I realized what had happened. Here's the Rebbe sitting at his desk in Brooklyn dealing with very significant, massive issues of Jews in different communities, you know, all sorts of very big issues. And he obviously also was thinking about one person, my father, who's lying in a hospital bed having suffered a bad stroke, who's probably feeling very disoriented and very sad and feeling that his life of creativity and his useful life is coming to an end. And so he comes up with a question that he sensed my father could answer. Now, did his awareness that my father could answer it, did it come from the fact that he had, you know, he could channel and know things that the rest of us couldn't know? Was it a question just that he used an extraordinary amount of common sense, or as I called it earlier, moral imagination? Whatever it was, he had a question, and my father was able to answer it. And by doing so, the fact that my father lying there like that, the Rebbe is still consulting with him about a question, obviously was a very powerful experience for my father. And from that point on, it was just not a question then of having, you know, knowing the Rebbe was a major figure, having a lot of admiration for him. Obviously, it evoked in me an enormous sense of gratitude and affection. And so I wrote a book. I wrote an article on the 12th anniversary of the Rebbe's death for the Forward, the Jewish newspaper. And I told that story in it. And that was part of the whole process that brought me to, that made me aware that here was truly the subject for a big and important book, because this is a man who fashioned a big and important movement. Now, remember, I hadn't really written biographies before. Most of my books are in different aspects of Jewish life. So that wasn't my natural genre. I had written a book. I had helped a man, a friend of mine, Danny Abraham, write a memoir. And I had written a book on Hillel. But Hillel was an easier subject to write about. One of the reasons is there's no mention of Hillel outside of the Talmudic Midrashic literature. So as a result, all the material about him is contained, you know, is
easier subject to work with.
Right. Whereas here, everything had to be basically searched out, documented. And I had the additional problem for a writer that I'm writing about a man who is not an obscure man. The details of his life might not be that well known. On the other hand, you have several thousand very loyal Hasidim, you know, in the whose favorite activity is exchanging stories about the Rebbe. The biggest, the hardest thing for me in a way to do was to find a story that I could authenticate and that the Hasidim did not know. I was very averse to including anonymous material, because anonymous material, frankly,
can't be verified.
You don't know whether it's accurate or not. You know, even if it's basically accurate, it could be widely exaggerated. So I almost always wanted to have somebody who was willing to say they knew this as a fact to be true.
Mm-hmm. Good. Anyway, last question. Are you surprised with the book's initial success? Harper wrote, according as of Friday morning, Harper Collins says that there's 55,000 volumes in print. You're in on
that. Wait, how many do they say is in print now?
55,000.
Okay. I am surprised. I'm pleasantly surprised. I'm not shocked. I was very pleasantly surprised that the book is now, the New York Times now, and when it releases its list, it's part of the Times bestseller list. Publishers Weekly, it was number 6, you know, in its first week of publication. This has just been extraordinarily gratifying for a writer, because I really did want to write a book that would help introduce the Rebbe to an even broader audience. When I was interviewed on a friend of mine's program, Dennis Prager, you know, and Dennis was, who's most of whose listenership are not Jewish, and he said, listen, there are things for non-Buddhists to learn when they read about the Dalai Lama, and there's a lot for non-Jews as well to learn when they read about the Rebbe. In fact, oddly enough, the book currently is number 1 in the category on Amazon of Christian leadership. So a lot of Christians obviously have gotten sufficiently intrigued. This was, because this was the most famous rabbi, I would argue, probably since Maimonides, 800 years ago.
Indeed.
So not surprisingly, there are non-Jews who've heard about him, and they want to know what made this man special, and is there something from him that we can learn? So I wanted to introduce that element to the Rebbe, and the fact that the sales have gotten off to a very strong start makes me feel that I've helped. I've been blessed to help play a role in filling a need that was really there.
Mm-hmm. My wife said that this book actually shouldn't be in the biography section. It should actually be in the self-help section, because of learning about the Rebbe and what the Rebbe wanted people to do and how people should even think about themselves. It seems that your book has accomplished this, and it's indeed, Rabbi Joseph Plushkin, a very monumental work in which he continued success.
Thank you. That is so kind. And tell your wife, I'm greatly indebted to her for that comment, because it echoes what I feel. There's a section in the book called Seven Virtues, which are teachings of the Rebbe that anybody can incorporate into their lives. And from my perspective, that was a very essential part of the book.
Great. Okay, we're out of time. We're actually over time, but this has been fascinating and wonderful and very entertaining. The book is Rebbe by Joseph Plushkin, The Life and Teachings of Menachem M. Schneerson Lubavitcher Rebbe, the most influential rabbi in modern history. Thank you so much for coming on, and keep us surprised.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to meeting.
Take care.
In person.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Do you or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility, with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. Up for your listening pleasure, this is the Klezmatics, playing the Violonische Deune, which means a violin song. assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
The Art Studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the Art Studio of Oak Park has something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Art Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Art Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
There's Shlomo Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour just because we can. Here's Schlockrock, Find Your Way Back Home. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Hey, Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. Just a quick mention of the portion as time is fleeting by. This week is a portion of Balak found in chapter 20 and following in the book of Numbers and deals with a Moabite king who really wanted to do the Jews in. What was his modus operandi? He stood up and said, look what the Jews did. In last week's portion, they killed Sihon and Og, the world's two greatest superpowers. We were vassal states to them. They were our protection. They're gone. We're doomed unless we do something. Now, if your leader was saying that to you, what would you do? You'd feel panic. Me personally, Windsor Tunnel. I'm out of here. What did Moses do? What was Moses' deal? Moses was told to attack Sihon and Og. They were some pretty scary people. They were huge. I mean, as far as superpowers go, this was like an undertaking. You have to get rid of them because they're always going to be a problem. What did Moses do? Moses sucked it up. In fact, Moses went hand to hand with Og. And it says about Og that Moses jumped up in the air 18 feet with a stick or sword that was 18 feet long and hit Og in the ankle. So Og was a big boy and knocked him over and killed him. Moses did fear Og. This is like a formidable opponent, but he never let it on. He told the people, he told them, listen, God is with us. We can do this. That's what a leader's supposed to do. A leader's supposed to lead down the right path. So now, how does this relate to us? We basically are our own leaders. We have to direct ourselves the right way. Don't psych yourself out of something. Psych yourself into it. We got to take a quick commercial break. We're going to be right back. Don't go away. The Hasidic story is next. You're listening to the Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard from the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor the Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for the Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep the Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to the Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Hey, Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? Easiest way, rabbifinman.com. You have the contact page over there. You'll be able to touch with me. A lot of people got in touch with me last week. It was really awesome, wonderful. I love it. Feedback, terrific. Tell me what I'm doing wrong, because that way I correct it. I make the show better. You'll find archived editions of the show, archived editions of other things that I produce, classes and whatnot. And you like listening to the Jewish Hour? My mother used to say, there's no free lunch, nothing. My grandmother used to say, for nothing, you get nothing. And for cheap, you get cheap. And for nothing, you get nothing, was what she used to say. So this isn't free. This costs a lot of money to keep this show on the air. It is Detroit's only Jewish source of radio programming. It's accessible around the world. So go to rabbifinman.com, go to the donations page, and make a donation today. I'm not going to say that it's the last week of June and we haven't paid June yet. We got July next week, you know, so. But if you don't like doing internet donations, fine. Send any donation to any amount to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. A couple weeks ago, I told a story involving a child that had an eye disease. And there was a doctor, Andrew Halbus, mentioned in the story. And the story went that he yelled at them, what did you do? How did you take this kid to another doctor? And he said, we didn't take a doctor to another doctor. We got a blessing from Lubavitcher Rebbe. And he said, oh, okay. So that made me wonder, what? How is he so complacent about that? And here's the backstory on that. There was an Israeli girl back in 1984 who was 16 and a half years old. Her name was Chaya Riva Grossbaum from Migdal Emek. And she got an eye something going on, and it was serious. They went to doctors all over the place, and no one could help her, and it was getting worse. And this went on for 6 months, and all the doctors just agreed on one thing, that she's going to lose vision in that eye. So the father came over to America, and someone told him, go visit Dr. Halbus. He's a world specialist in ophthalmology. So he brought the file with him. He brought the x-rays, and then he's a good doctor. Rabbi Halbus said, I need to see the girl. I can't look from here. So they got the girl on a plane. Next, she came in. She said, before she went anything, she says, I want to see the Rebbe. There were Lubavitchers, of course. They drove from Kennedy. They drove straight to 770 World Headquarters, the Lubavitch Movement, and got there in time to be there when the Rebbe came into the office that morning. There was a crowd of people, and this, Rabbi Grossbaum said to himself, I got to do this for my daughter. And as the Rebbe was walking up the stairs, this protocol was is that people moved to the side and let the Rebbe pass through. He, Rabbi Grossbaum, jumped in front of the Rebbe and said, Rebbe, please give a bracha for my daughter. Here she is. She just came to Israel. We're seeing a specialist. The Rebbe looked at her and said, check the mezuzahs, the scrolls on your doors. And he went into his office. So he right away ran to the phone, called up his wife and said, immediately, have all the scrolls, all the mezuzahs checked. They found the mezuzah on her bedroom door was missing a word. It says, you shall put them as a sign between your eyes. And the word eyes was missing. They replaced the mezuzah. And this girl who had gone to sleep, because you know what it is, 14 hours on a plane, when she woke up, she said, my eye stopped hurting for the first time in 7 months. And he said, yeah, it looks better. So they went to the doctor who had that appointment that day, Rabbi Andrew Halbus, Dr. Andrew Halbus, and he took a look at all of the x-rays and the CAT scans that she brought with him, a CAT scan from 2 days before. And he looked at her and said, this is not the same person. There's nothing here. And they said, it is. We got a blessing from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And he said, Dr. Halbus, I have just witnessed a miracle. There was no way that anything was going to help this girl. 18 years later, this Rabbi Grossbaum was a guest speaker at some function of some synagogue in New Jersey. And when he walked in the door, somebody ran up, greeted him, and just was like his best friend. And he kind of looked at him quizzically and he said, don't you remember me? I'm Dr. Halbus. I'm the one who you consulted with your daughter. Because of that, I've become more religious. That's the story. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you see you back again next week. Next week's a fast. We'll talk about that then. Have a good week. Bye.